This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN. Pete Zimmerman produces. I'm John Williams, the chief investment strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Is Jason Turner. The GDP fell 0.9% in the second quarter. Jason, what does that mean to us?
Well, consensus expectations had been looking for a very slight increase in GDP growth for the quarter. So the pullback, the negative number, is a little bit of a surprise versus the consensus, although certainly within the range of outcomes. I think we were looking at a range of outcomes between a decline of 1.5% and a gain of 1.5%. What it's telling us is that the economy is certainly slowing at this point from the dual headwinds of the continued challenges of this cycle and Fed action, but also from the impact of inflation.
Well, is this then tamped down inflation? This doesn't sound like good news. It's a harbinger of a recession, but is it also good news on the inflationary front?
I think if we peel back the onion and look at some of the numbers inside of that headline GDP number, we'll see some evidence that consumer demand, which has been one of the driving factors in pushing inflation higher, is certainly starting to slow. For example, if we strip out volatile segments of the spending range, food and energy, we take out the headwinds we're facing from the fading government spending, you're looking at consumer spending or private domestic purchases being flat quarter over quarter. That's a big change from the 3% increase we saw in that number in the first quarter.
What other numbers are you looking at? What is the inflationary number right now?
So our last inflation print was north of 9%, driven largely by an increase in energy. We have seen energy prices here over the month of July moderate to some extent, particularly the price of the pump that has been a constant worry for most consumers. As we see that energy focus pull back, we'll start to see things like rents continue to drive inflationary pressure for the next few months. Rent has a lag impact on those inflation prints. So we're 3 to 6 months out from seeing the full impact of the rising rents in inflation. So my base case is in inflation, that top line print is going to stay higher as we move towards the end of the year and then finally start to moderate as we close into the fourth quarter.
Markets are pretty good. Dow's up 269 right now. What do you make of that?
Yeah, the markets took both today's GDP announcement and yesterday's Federal Reserve meeting and interest rate increase as good news. And it maybe sound counterintuitive, but from the Fed's perspective, it's really wrapped into some comments after the meeting that the Fed is aware of the impacts of a slowing economy. They're aware of their policy's impact on continuing to slow the economy. And I think Chair Powell gave us a bit of a viewpoint into the September Fed meeting that they will be data dependent and will potentially start to back off the accelerator in terms of the speed at which they're raising rates to combat inflation, maybe take a little bit less of a focus on raising rates in the near term and take a longer term view. And the market digested that to the positive.
I don't know how people are supposed to accept the economic news these days. I mean, I think people are right now just allowing themselves a breath because the free fall of the markets, it wasn't a free fall, but 20%, they were noticing that on their statements. And now for the last couple of weeks, there have been sizable gains and they feel good about that. And then you see a headline like CNBC, GDP falls 0.9% in second quarter, second straight decline, strong recession signal. So, okay, that sounds bad, but I think people right now are also feeling a little good about their retirement chances.
I think people are feeling a little relieved at the both the GDP print and the Fed action, that the Fed is taking inflation seriously now after maybe getting too late to the party in fighting inflation. They're taking inflation seriously. That's a positive for investors because a lot of that fear and a lot of the inflationary impact was already priced in for the last several months. The same with this GDP pullback. At a down 0.9% instead of down 1.5%, this number largely driven by a pretty significant pullback in businesses stocking inventories, much less than consumer activity. That gives investors some encouragement that maybe this won't be as bad as we've already priced into the market. And we've seen that in terms of the market's rebound from about the midpoint of June through now.
Jason Turner, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Wintrustwealth.com is the website. Okay, Jason, we'll talk again soon. Thanks for your time today.
All right, thanks, John.
Joan Salzman is the senior reporter at CNET, regularly joins us to talk about things tech. Let's talk about Facebook reporting its first ever revenue drop, Joan. Is that a big deal?
Yeah, certainly it is for Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook, the first decline in its revenue ever in its history. It underscores the fact that, you know, it, like a lot of companies, are contending with a dampening of the digital advertising market, not to mention for Facebook and Meta in particular, increasing competition from upstart rivals like TikTok.
But it didn't mean they lost money, but rather their revenue didn't grow from the previous period. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So the quarterly revenue, we're talking about the second quarter for Meta, was $28.8 billion, which is down almost a percentage point. I'm sorry, not a percentage point, down almost 1% from a year earlier. So they're still getting lots of money coming in. It's just not as much loss as it was the year before.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know exactly how to write that headline, but it would seem to me like another way to put it would be, wow, Facebook made $28 billion. But I guess if you're following the chart, you hate to see it peak and start to go down, and maybe this is the start of that, right?
Yeah, and another consideration is that for a lot of tech companies, the growth is the premise. The growth is baked in. So, for example, Netflix has seen a significant downturn in its share price over this year, purely based on the fact that they aren't growing their base, their membership yeah. base, at first as much as they had, and then started to lose some of them, losing some of their members. Which, you know, you could look at like, well, hey, they're still the most dominant streaming service in the entire world, the entire planet. But with tech companies, it really is investors and others. It's all about the growth. And so when a gigantic tech company like Meta has the first decline in revenue that it's ever had, that really underwhelms the kind of growth premise for why you would be invested in this company.
What about Google? How are they doing?
So they're not doing quite as bad, but still not great. You know, they reported their slowest quarterly sales growth in 2 years. And the reason why that's sort of important is Google, even more so than Meta and Facebook, is considered the bellwether for the strength of online advertising. And Google, Facebook, Meta, they're just sort of cornerstones of this entire internet economy that really is based on online advertising. So slowdowns for Google can suggest further weakness in a market critical to a lot of internet companies.
Instagram is in the news, addresses the Kardashian backlash. What's the Kardashian backlash?
Right. So earlier, Kylie Jenner and Kim Kardashian both sort of went public that Instagram should stop trying to be like TikTok. And for whatever people feel about Kylie Jenner and Kim Kardashian, it can't be denied that they're social media powerhouses. Kylie Jenner has 360 million followers on Instagram, and Kim Kardashian has 326 million followers. But it was enough to get the CEO of Instagram to post something saying, hey, we're pushing for changes, but I promise we're not going to abandon the photo experience that everybody knows and loves.
And what is that? I mean, what's the difference between Instagram and TikTok?
Yeah, well, one of the things that kind of is at issue here is, you know, Instagram is known for kind of what it is for photo sharing and also the sort of culture that's grown up there. TikTok is a lot different. It's, you know, these short form loops, fun, you know, basically it can be a lot of things, but it's short form looping videos. And so Instagram doing some experiments with things like full screen video, shorter videos, looping videos, that has felt disruptive to people that are used to a more traditional Instagram experience, those people including apparently Kylie Jenner and Kim Kardashian.
Yeah. Spotify, what's the news on that app or platform?
Yeah, Spotify is very quickly killing off its first and only hardware just months after launching it. In February, Spotify launched a device called CarThing, And with a name like that, I'm sure you're surprised that it decided a few months later that it's going to pull the plug. Yeah. You know, Spotify said it tried a variety of price points for the device, which is basically something that mounts to the dashboard of a car and acts as a sophisticated remote control for listening to Spotify through your car's speakers powered by your phone. But Spotify said they just couldn't get the sales volume that justified keeping it going.
If your name is Car Thing, yeah, you think maybe we, this product, New Coke wasn't available? I mean, if that's, if that's the name of the product, then maybe, yeah, you haven't thought through all of the possible scenarios, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, to be fair to Car Thing, to, you know, RIP Car Thing, to be fair to the legacy of Car Thing, you know, this is a time when, you know, in trend, you know, very skilled device makers are having trouble with supply chain issues, with inflation causing component prices to go up. So the problems that Car Thing faced, there's things that other devices on the market are also facing. But Car Thing, A, is called Car Thing, and B, it's being manufactured by a company whose specialty isn't making hardware. And so I think those forces combined really made Car Thing have a tough hill to drive up on.
But it also makes me wonder if any hardware devices are needed for the dashboard. The integration of the hardware and software inside the car these days, your screen is so sophisticated anymore. I don't need a Garmin. You know, it's all built in, right?
Yeah, it is for a lot of cars. But what Spotify was sort of targeting with this device is there's also a lot of cars in, you know, the fleet on the road right now that don't have a fancy infotainment system. You know, people that don't want to either rip out their dashboard or buy an entirely new car to have a really great streaming music experience in their car. And so Spotify, I think, was trying to address that market of people. But, you know, I think what they found is that that market of people can't address that need, not quite as well and not quite as sophisticatedly as a Car Thing, but just by getting a really good smartphone mount to put on their dashboard instead of buying a whole other device in order to be able to interact through that device on your phone with Spotify.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Joan Salzman, senior reporter, CNET.com. Let's talk again soon. Thank you, Joan.
Great to talk to you, John.
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about this now. Greg McBride, senior vice president and chief analyst at Bankrate.com. I'm not surprised, and I'm a little surprised at what you guys dug up, and that is America's favorite long-term investment. Welcome back, Greg. How are you?
Great to be with you, John. Good afternoon.
So if we were going to maybe have a nest egg down the road, the money is in what?
Yeah, I think for most people, it's in their homes. They do continue to view real estate as the best place for money that they wouldn't need for more than a decade. It's the third time in the last 4 years, sixth time in the last decade that real estate has come out on top. And John, even in the years where real estate doesn't come out on top, it's typically a close second, maybe third. It really doesn't, the percentage that point to it is very consistent. Don't see the volatility there that we do on some of the other choices.
Stock market's number two, right?
Yeah, and that was the surprise. You mentioned you weren't surprised, but you were surprised. I'm right there with you because the real estate, that wasn't surprising. What was surprising was to see the stock market actually had increased relative to what people had said a year ago. Last year was only 16% of people pointed to the stock market. This year it was up to 26%. And of course, that comes despite this bear market that we had seen here in the first part of 2022. So I'm reassured by that. I think, you know, that's certainly an appropriate choice, just a bit uncharacteristic for what we've seen in years past when there's a sharp drawdown in the market. Usually the market isn't the only thing that falls, the sentiment does as well.
So how do you explain that? In a bear market, more Americans say that's their second choice for long-term investments.
Yeah, this is consistent with something else we had found back in May in a separate survey, which 56% of investors, stock market investors, had held pat in the first half of the year, and a little bit more than half planned to invest the same amount of money this year as they did last year, despite all the volatility that we've seen. And so I think seeing the rapid market drop in the first part of 2020 at the outset of the pandemic. And then the rebound that came thereafter, you've got a whole new generation of investors that's really their first view or experience of this idea that, oh, if I just hang on, it will come back. And so I think that's why you're seeing a little bit more maybe disciplined or patient behavior from individual investors this time around relative to what we had seen in years past.
I have a son who's in his early 30s and has, for the first time, looked at his statements and went, oh, crap. And I'm like, well, you've had a nice run. You know, if you've been putting money in the market for the last 5 years, that's not even real. And I also told him, I said, you know, I'm going to be drawing down my account a lot sooner than you. This dip in the market is a buying opportunity. Your horizon is 30 years, for crying out loud. So he said he looked at his statement and the number was bad. I said, well, I haven't looked at my statement because I know it's bad. I'm not even going to torture myself. If I were him, I'd look at it because who cares?
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, he should embrace the volatility because he's making those regular paycheck contributions. Like you said, he's got a 30-year time horizon. And that's just until retirement. He may have another 30 years in retirement. So this is very much long-term money. And, you know, in that perspective, you welcome a market pullback, gives you a great buying opportunity. But, yeah, it's not as fun looking at the 401k balance this year as it was last year when it went up every time you looked, that's for sure.
Well, I'll give you his number. So, you know, the other thing that's kind of funny about this to me is that you say, what's your favorite long-term investment? Well, it's stock market. It's people have it in cash, gold, bonds. Your survey shows 6% say Bitcoin because they must be gamblers. But real estate is kind of a funny part of your portfolio because you're not dollar cost averaging real estate. You have a house. If you're really lucky, you have a lake house. But people don't buy up a lot of real estate. They just kind of hope that their home has appreciated when they sell it. That's a fair read on it, isn't it?
I think for a lot of people, yes, that is the appropriate read. What I would point out, though, is that home ownership is not the only avenue into real estate exposure. So even if you're an aspiring homeowner, but you've seen prices go up and mortgage rates go up, and you feel like that target is just moving further away from you, you can still diversify your portfolio and get real estate exposure. You can do it through real estate investment trusts, real estate sector funds, those type of things, and oftentimes with very minimal investment. So it's not as if home ownership is the only avenue to real estate exposure, although it is the primary avenue for about 2/3 of Americans.
That is an interesting point. Are you recommending that? You're not a financial advisor, are you, Greg? But what do you say about our REITs these days?
Well, I'm a fan of a diversified portfolio, and particularly one that can grow your buying power over time. You know, real estate investment trusts, you know, much like dividend paying stocks, they pay out a growing stream of cash flows over time. It's a great way to generate income for retirees, but it's also great compounding, even for younger investors looking to diversify a little bit, compounding those annual income flows. You know, really, it adds up over time, and it's a valuable part of your total return. You just hold them in a tax advantage account rather than a taxable account because they're kind of a nightmare at tax time otherwise.
What's the consumer sentiment about cryptocurrency right now?
Well, kind of like the prices, the sentiment has gone down sharply since last year. You mentioned the 6% that pointed to that this year as their preferred investment for periods longer than a decade. Down from the peak last year, it had been up over 9%. But I think the other really telling thing there, John, about crypto was when we asked about comfort level with cryptocurrency, not surprisingly, that has eroded pretty significantly over the last year. 3 in 4 of those surveyed said they're uncomfortable investing in cryptocurrencies, up pretty sharply from 61% last year. But even among Gen Z investors, the youngest investors, 2/3 of Gen Z said they were uncomfortable investing in cryptocurrencies.
Somebody said, I know my friend Eric Zorn, who publishes a newsletter, one of his favorite tweets of the week was something like, I don't know anything about cryptocurrency, and that strategy has paid off handsomely. It's like, just don't even go there, and you're probably better off than gambling with that. That was a tweet. Maybe somebody else has figured it out. It's nice to talk to you. Greg McBride, Senior Vice President, Chief Analyst at Bankrate.com. We'll visit again. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, John.
Take care. It's 12:45. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Rivian is cutting about 6% of its workforce, but the cutbacks will not affect the company's factory in Downstate Normal. The electric vehicle maker announced the job cuts yesterday. A memo from the company's head says inflation, higher interest rates, and higher commodity prices have hurt Rivian's ability to raise additional financing. Rivian makes electric pickups and SUVs in addition to delivery vans. Amazon workers at one of the company's warehouses in Joliet have filed charges with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, alleging a hostile work environment. The complaint says a racist death threat was found written in a women's bathroom. A lawyer representing the Amazon workers says a total of 26 complaints have been filed about conditions at the warehouse with the EEOC and the Illinois Department of Human Rights. The lawyer says Amazon opened an investigation but has not shared the results of that probe with workers. A statement from Amazon says hate or racism have no place in our society and are not tolerated by Amazon. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Here's Steve Alexander.
And we are sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Helping us out today is Bruce Springsteen. And there's no dynamic pricing for this one. It is the most wonderful time of the year for a lot of us. It is time for
the County Fair.
Yes, County Fair time. And McHenry's is next week.
Everybody.
Well, it's coming up August 2 through the 7th in Woodstock.
Rich Tobias is the spokesman for the McHenry County Fair. And before we talk about food, Rich, will the Orion Samuelson kissing booth be in operation this year?
Not that I know of. I thought, you know, Orion was taking a break from that this year.
Probably a good choice. But Big O is a proud resident of the county.
Yes, he is. He lives here in McHenry, and he's an icon for WGN and an icon for the fair.
Okay, to the food.
We have a lot of different types of food, but the first thing that comes to mind to going to a fair is an elephant ear or a funnel cake.
What's the difference?
Well, they're both fried dough, but the elephant ear is based on a Navajo recipe for a fried flatbread. The funnel cake is squeezed out of a bottle or a funnel. Both are topped with powdered sugar, maybe whipped cream, maybe some fruit. And they tend to be a bit messy, but they are so good.
But wait, there's more.
There's a lot of local vendors who bring in their food trucks or their trailers. And new this year, we have Polish deli coming in. So you think pierogi, because they're really good pierogi. I've had some before. And then, of course, you've got 4-H that has a food booth. They're the ones that serve breakfast typically through dinner. The Farm Bureau, the farmers all get together, and you've got your pork burger and your rib sandwich, and then you finish off the day with a hand-dipped ice cream.
Lots of things on sticks, I suppose. Plenty of deep-fried items, too?
They have deep-fried pickles. I've seen deep-fried Oreos, the deep-fried Twinkie, of course.
But there's a lot more than food at the McHenry County Fair.
Saturday is our big concert with Big and Rich and their special guest, Sarah Evans. And then on Sunday to end the whole fair, we have the traditional demo derby.
It's all next week in Woodstock.
Beautiful downtown Woodstock, right at the corner, basically the corner of McConnell and 47, right behind the Jewel.
Thank you, Rich Tobias. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Derek Mancini's on a phone line, the owner and manager and distiller at Quincy Street Distillery in Riverside, Illinois. Hey, Derek, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm fine, John. How are you doing?
I hope other people don't make that mistake and they drive to Quincy looking for your place.
Once in a while, people get confused. We're Quincy Street Distillery because we're on Quincy Street in Riverside, Illinois. And if you know, the train line that goes through, which is the Burlington Aurora line, was originally the Chicago Burlington Quincy Railroad. And if you go along that line, there are usually Quincy Streets and Burlington Roads along the line every village.
Hold on one second. I want to make sure we get a better line. I'm having trouble understanding you. Maybe our listeners are as well. So let's reconnect with him real quick here, Producer Pete. We're talking about the Quincy Street Distillery, and he mentioned it's right off the BNSF line, the Metrotrax there. in Riverside, Illinois. Derek Mancini is the owner and manager of this distillery, which was born out of the craft distillery heritage. They create historically inspired spirits based on classic and original formulas, which I'm reading from their stuff now, results in a unique expression of taste. Let's try it again. Are you still there?
I'm still there. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, I think this is going to work better now. So tell us about your place. What's the secret sauce for you guys? What do you distill and what's your niche?
Well, let's see. As you know, Riverside, Illinois is a very historic village. It was founded in 1869 by Frederick Law, a bunch of people wanting to make an investment, taking advantage of the train line. It's also a very interesting place because it was meant to be a resort as well as being a bedroom community for merchants. So it was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, and it's all curvy streets and tree-lined and had all the modern conveniences. So it's very historical. So we were inspired to open a distillery that's all about historicity, which is about making historical-style spirits, using historical methods, and even our branding is with local and regional historical people, places, and things. And we're founded over 10 years ago and started production exactly a decade ago. And we were the fifth craft distillery in the state when that happened. But we are one of the smallest. Almost everything we make is handmade on-site using a small copper pot still. Nevertheless, we make over like 25 different products, including whiskeys like bourbon and malt whiskey, malt rye whiskey and corn whiskey, also unusual gins and vodka made from our bourbon paints, rum and honey spirit and absinthe. This is really quite a lot of things that are done there. And the interesting thing is that it gets me, as a retired scientist, to combine my interest in making things and using science and technology and history, because I also have a history degree, and put it all into one, what essentially has turned into a second career.
That is a clever idea. I've not heard of a place like this. So it's a cocktail bar, but it's also a distillery. Is that right?
Right. So a very small distillery. Everything's made on site. But we're in this building that was renovated about 10 years ago, and it was originally a pre-prohibition industrial arts and crafts building. And so it's a very historical-looking building. And in the storefront, we have this small speakeasy cocktail bar, and that serves craft cocktails using our spirits. So we're operating the distillery five weekdays a week, but the craft cocktail bar, the speakeasy, is only open Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays currently, although we do the tours of the distillery with tastings that are on Saturday and Sundays. So it's a destination location in some ways for people who are interested in craft spirits and craft cocktails and also in historical things. It's a historical village. One of the things that can attract people to come to visit Riverside. But like the village, it's a small, out-of-the-way place. I mean, Riverside, if you've been there, you know, it's this very bucolic village. It still has its 19th century feel, and which has made it a very special place to live and raise a family. We've been here for about 27 years and raised our family here, and that's part of why we ended up opening the business here, because we live like a block away from the distillery.
I'm looking at the menu of things you concoct. Gin, you mentioned, vodka, bourbon, rye, absinthe, for crying out loud.
Yeah, we make pretty much, every time I want to make another cocktail, I have to make the spirit for it.
Some of us just go to the store and buy it, but no, there you are tinkering with your vats and your drums. Good on you, sir. All right. I guess maybe just start at QuincyStreetDistillery.com for more information would be a good way for our listeners to find you, huh?
That's right. And if they want to make a reservation, whether it is to go to the bar, it can be busy on the weekend, or and it's very small, or if they want to book a tour, they can do that through talk.com.
QuincyStreetDistillery.com also works. Derek Mancini. Good luck, Derek. Thanks for your time today. Congratulations.
All right. Thank you very much.